Thank you. We're joined, as usual, by Rhode Island Public Radio political analyst Scott McKay. Hello, Scott.
Good morning, Rhode Island.
And University of Rhode Island political science professor Maureen Moakley. Good morning, Maureen.
Good morning, everyone.
We're talking about civil liberties to mark the 4th of July, so we're pleased to welcome as our guest the executive director of the Rhode Island chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us, Steve.
Thank you, Ian.
Governor Lincoln Chafee this week signed into law a bill to add up to 10 years in prison for people convicted of gang-related activity. Supporters call this measure a necessary tool for police, but critics say it will be used to target poor minorities while perpetuating the prison-industrial complex. Steve Brown, are there already adequate laws on the books from your perspective to prosecute gang-related crime?
There certainly are. Anybody who's involved in a gang and committing crimes faces a whole range of penalties, felony penalties with serious prison time in them. As you indicated in summarizing the opponent's position on this, we believe it really is a tool that will be used to target and harass minority youth for no good purpose, to coerce individuals to plead to crimes that they might be innocent of for fear of getting this extra 10-year sentence attached to their offense. So we do think that it's a totally unnecessary bill and a counterproductive one as well, because it could encourage gang members to coerce people who aren't involved in gangs to do things for them. They're the ones who'll face these enhanced penalties, not the gang leaders themselves.
Scott, Lincoln Chafee is hardly a law and order conservative. What's your read on why he signed this bill into law?
Well, the legislature passed it. You only want to fight so many times with those people if you're governor. I think it's feel-good legislation for a lot of people who are upset about the fact that we still in our inner cities have way too much crime, violence. And it strikes me that it kind of takes the level playing field away from the defense and puts it in the prosecutor's hands. As Steve says, they can now charge people with more crimes, and that way they can probably try to, wield a better plea bargain. I don't think this in and of itself is really going to serve as a deterrent for a lot of the young, particularly males, who are involved in our inner cities in this kind of crime.
Maureen, what do you think of this new law?
I completely agree with the reservations about it. First of all, it seems to me we're moving away from the model of lock them up and throw away the key kind of thing. And we're trying to be more nuanced, and we're trying to do something about what you talk about, the prison industrial complex. So anything that, puts more constraints on allowing to understand what's happening in terms of individuals and, passes this kind of legislation. Frankly, I'm surprised that Chafee went ahead and signed it because he's not a law and order kind of guy, and I think it serves no purpose.
Since we have Steve Brown here, let's ask him, how do you evaluate this year's legislative session from a civil liberties perspective? What were the best and worst elements?
I think it's like most sessions. It could have been a lot better. It could have been a lot worse. In terms of problematic legislation, I think the bill we just talked about is one of the downsides of the session. I think another one that we'll be talking about is a DNA bill that the General Assembly passed after many years of not passing it. It requires the taking of DNA samples from people who are merely arrested for certain designated offenses. And we see that as a tremendous step backwards in terms of trying to deal with new technology and protecting privacy rights. On the other hand, there were a few very good bills that passed. Certainly the bill establishing a 3-year moratorium on the use of high-stakes testing for high school students was, from our perspective, a very, very positive development, one that needed to happen for a whole host of reasons. And there were a few other positive bills that the legislature passed. On the whole, I think the best things that happened were bills that didn't pass, that could have caused even more damage to civil liberties than the bills that did pass already do.
Maureen, what's your explanation for why such an overwhelmingly Democratic legislature like the one we have here in Rhode Island sometimes enacts bills that don't seem consistent with Democratic or liberal values?
I think it has more to do with the fact that there's a cadre of very conservative Democrats that in another state would be Republican. I mean, the breakdown in this state doesn't work out the way it does in other places because the core, think about gay marriage and the people that were the Republican supported, and there were a lot of Democrats opposition. So the partisan breakdown doesn't really work in this state, and it is there's a conservative Catholic strain that exists.
Yeah, there are a lot of Dinos, Democrats in name only, in the Rhode Island legislature. Part of this is simply because we're a one-party state, and conservatives tend to run for the legislature if they think they can win. So do liberals. So the ideological breakdowns happen in Rhode Island, not between the Republican and Democratic parties, but within this kind of one-party Democratic controlled House and Senate.
Let's stay with Scott here. In the Hobby Lobby case, the U.S. Supreme Court this week decided that private employers with religious objections don't have to provide contraception under Obamacare. Your reaction, Scott?
I'm interested in the political fallout here. I noticed all the Republican presidential candidates, except for Chris Christie, the New Jersey governor, he dodged the question. All the rest of them said, you know, the Rand Pauls, the Ted Cruzes, this was a great decision. I think this is crazy on Republicans' part of view, because I think it's okay to be the anti-abortion party, but I'm not sure you want to be the anti-contraception party. And, you know, you're putting an employer between a doctor and a woman as far as her health and her family planning and her sexual life, and I'm not sure that's where you want to be. The other bad part of this precedent, and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg alluded to this, what if a Jehovah's Witness owns a company and says you shouldn't have blood transfusions, or a Christian Scientist? Now, I know the court said this was narrowly tailored, but I'm not so sure that you set a precedent like this that someone can't try to take this to another step. And I worry in a pluralistic society that we're really ending that tradition, and that's sad.
Steve Brown, what is your takeaway from the Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby decision?
Well, I think it is a very dangerous decision. You know, religious freedom is very important in this country. It's something that the ACLU believes very strongly in. But I was really struck by how the majority opinion in this case really ignored the other end, the other part of the ledger, which is women's health. I mean, it really didn't address that at all. And that's very concerning. And as Scott noted, you know, the opinion tries to keep it narrow, but there's no principled basis in the opinion for explaining why you can deny women access to contraceptive care and not also do it with all the other things. So is this, in fact, just an opinion, you know, one day only to harm women? That's the question that arises.
What was your reaction to this decision, Maureen?
I had a similar reaction. I do think that it is narrowly drawn. I understand that there can be, this is an opening for other arguments, and when you get to those arguments, they're very problematic. But as it exists now, on the face of it, it is narrowly drawn, and it's probably, you know, women will get this kind of care from insurance companies because it's cheaper to deal with this than it is to deal with, you know, other aspects of having either abortions or childbirth, frankly. So, I mean, I think it's narrowly drawn, but I do agree that it's disturbing because there isn't an underlying principle that could prevent an extension of the argument.
We're a little short on time here, but Rhode Island voters will be asked in November if they want to convene a constitutional convention. Supporters say this is a way to create changes like a line item veto for the governor, for which the General Assembly shows no interest. But critics like our guest Steve Brown say a con mostly opens the door for a series of reactionary changes. What do you think, Maureen?
I completely agree. I am completely against the idea of a constitutional convention. It does open the door to all sorts of groups. I can see the gun lobby right now. And I really think it's a you know, sort of a venue or arena for mischief, and I agree.
Steve Brown, how about that argument from the other side, that the General Assembly shows no interest in some good government measures, and this might be, a con might be the way to do it?
Well, it takes time and effort to get the General Assembly to do certain things, but that's the way it should work when you're talking about changing the constitution of our state. I think we also have to think about the damage that can be done from a constitutional convention, which can really just be a mini General Assembly on steroids, is how some people have put it, because that's what it's just as political a process, if not more so. And we have a history. We know what happened 30 years ago. It was an extremely political convention. It didn't deal with government reform at the top. The major issue was abortion. And I think we would see that again.
Last word here to Scott McKay.
Steve's right. Remember back in the 2-for-1, 1985, that's exactly what happened. The biggest thing that came out of there was an attempt to, on a state basis, overturn Roe v. Wade.
All right, we're out of time, so we have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us on Political Roundtable. Scott?
Great to be here.
Maureen?
Thank you.
And Steve Brown from the Rhode Island chapter of the ACLU.
Thank you.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Robertson Foundation, continuing the commitment of its founder, Stephen Hamblett, to honest government in Rhode Island through in-depth political coverage. If you enjoy the conversation, please visit our On Politics blog at ripr.org. And a very happy 4th of July to all our listeners.